Hello and welcome to Cubicle Confidential, weekly advice for the working stiff. I'm Chris DeSantis, and I'm here to share what I know and pretend that I know more than I do.
And I'm Tim McClure, and I love you for your brutal honesty. I help companies with strategy, structure, and market research. And I've recently rediscovered a show, I guess you'd call it a show, that I absolutely love.
And what is this show that you absolutely love?
I don't know if you can call it a show. Maybe Jack, you could be the arbiter of this, but it's a you know, it's on YouTube and it's called Hot Ones, and it's where, you know, this interviewer has people eat progressively hotter and hotter hot wings or, you know, sauce covered cauliflower if they're vegan.
I've seen this.
He interviews them. Have you ever seen this show?
Yes, it's good actually. He's a very good interviewer. I'm just amazed that they can consume these things.
Yeah, he must have an iron stomach. Jack, you ever seen this thing?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's on TV, too. Yeah, it's been turned into an actual TV show.
As per usual, in my advanced age, late to the party. But it's funny because I'll catch one, and then I'll kind of watch three or four in a row, and then I just sort of forget about it for a while. But every time I come back to it, because the host, Chris Evans, is such a... He does his homework. He asks incredible questions. He catches the guests off guard, and then, you know, kind of... hits them with a serious, deep question while their mouth is on fire and they're cursing their publicist. Anyway, anybody out there who has not checked out, I think it's technically the company's But First We Feast, something like that, but Hot Ones on YouTube or on TV, celebrity guests eating progressively hotter food, enduring the pain and a delightful interview at the same time. Anyway,
I don't have the tolerance.
Lost 2 hours of my life last night.
No, but I don't have the tolerance for hot. I like the idea of it, but it doesn't sit well with me.
Did you have any lasting effects from the chili milli last week? The little hot spicy gummy?
No. I do have a recollection of the flavor, which isn't necessarily something I want to remember. But I didn't. You know, there was a little bit of heat.
And if that's all there was, that's good. We don't want to get, this is a family show. We don't want to get too graphic, but you know, sometimes something really spicy is the gift that keeps on giving, if you know what I mean.
Well, isn't there a special Dorito chip out there? There's some kind of chip that's supposed to be the hottest chip you can eat. And they only have, and it's in a package of one. And apparently it's something very difficult to even consume one. Has anyone ever heard of this? I should look into that at some point.
Yeah, you know, this is not a good use of our technology, making these things that are so hot they can hurt you.
What's it they call it, the
Scoville unit, right? The scale of measure of how painfully hot something might be.
Interesting.
Let's cure the common cold, can we?
Yeah, it's the Packy chip. It's like this hottest chip on earth. And I think like they've taken it off the shelves, I think, because it's rumored to have, like, killed a couple people.
Yeah, I heard something about that too. Yeah. I heard something. I don't know if that's true or not, but yeah, but
it's hard to, you know, tie it together, but someone had a stroke and someone else had some other condition, but yeah. God.
Wow. Crazy.
Yeah, that's terrible. I don't mean to laugh. But that's just, you know, separately bad business model. You know, you're going to sell one chip, not selling another one. You know, what are we doing here?
Right. Right. Anyway, what's going on today? What are we doing today? Enough about hot. The show is hot. All right, hot. So
our theme, we got some good questions, some meaty questions, some prolific writers who reached out to the show under the theme of Mission Implausible. I'll read the first one. This is from Baffled in the Bay Area. Sending an SOS to the Cubicle Confidential team. I work in biz dev, that's business development for you operations folks, for an investment firm in San Francisco. We've grown from nothing to a strong mid-market player in the past 10 years. We have smart people who work really hard, but to be honest, we also benefited from a national surge in demand for the kind of investment we make. Geez, we're getting the whole story here, Chris.
Right.
Our CEO, who is also the majority shareholder in the firm, has set incredibly aggressive sales goals and wants us to be 3x our current size in the next 5 years. Our writer uses an exclamation mark. Could have used more than one there. Three times in 5 years seems like a lot.
Mm-hmm.
He thinks he's motivating us, but absolutely everyone knows we can't grow at that pace. Growth in our industry has slowed. We have way more competitors than we did a decade ago, and our current staff is already stretched thin and overworked. The entire team is demoralized. Nobody wants to tell the emperor he's not wearing clothes, but we know we're not going to hit our targets for this year. A big part of our comp is a discretionary bonus. Uh-oh. Any ideas on how to broach this subject, or should I just start job hunting again? Baffled in the Bay Area.
Wow. Well, Tim, let me go with this first, because my answers aren't going to be as good as yours, because this is your sweet spot. You know this stuff. You know about strategy. You know about going to market. You know customers and all of those things. I'm just going to make a few sort of random comments, if you don't mind. But I think there's two issues here. One is what your boss wants, and secondly, what you want and what you're willing to risk. So they're unique in themselves. And the first one, your boss, if everyone is saying to him this can be met, then you have a problem and a competitor inside the firm. So if they're all going, yeah, we can do this, then you're going to be the odd man out if you try to say we're not. Now, if not, but the other thing I also think about is, I think you have to look at this as a business case you'll make with your team, because you're in business development. Rather than go to the boss and say, I don't think we can do this, what I would do is I would track backwards on how you have grown over the last 10 years. I would chart it. I would say from year one to year 10, this is the chart. And then I would put a dot, or whatever you would call that, at what you, three times the size in 5 years. That empty place has to be filled, in the sense of what would we need to do in year 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 to get to this 5 years. And so what I would suggest is make a chart that says, okay, in the year one of this, we have to grow by this much. That means we have to have this many customers or clients, and we have to spend this. This is how many hours we spent to get to this point. This is how many hours we will have to spend to get to that point. And my point here is that You show the expense of resource and the required number of customers or scale of customers you need to do. You are not saying I can't do this. You are saying this is the challenge ahead of us. How do we do this under the circumstances or the resources that we have? You see what I'm saying? Let the CEO educate you and your team as to how to go about what you are saying is absent at this point. What do you think, Tim? What do you think?
Yeah, some great practical advice in there. I love that you went all Ross Perot with a chart.
I know. I thought a chart would be good, because, you know, everyone likes a chart.
Great pictures say a thousand words. You know, we do run into this all the time. And let's start out
right
with the most positive view possible of this, that you're lucky to work for a visionary leader, right? You don't feel lucky right now, and I totally understand that. Sometimes these folks set goals that stretch the organization, stretch their people. Sometimes that rubber band breaks, right? But sometimes, you know, you find a way to make it happen, and you know, it can be magic. But this feels like a really long putt, at a minimum. I'd say, you know, you're referencing the CEO, somebody who's an owner in the firm. Presumably there's some semi-classic structure here where there's a leader or two in between you and the person who set this goal. So, you know, kind of start there with who's your boss? Who's your supervisor? Hey, what do you think about this? This seems like a real heavy lift for us. You know, what's your view on this? So just sort of calibrate, like, are you the only one who thinks this is
right?
That's nuts?
Good. Right.
Or does everybody think it's nuts? And then I love, what you went to, which is, you know, break it down and what will it take to make this happen? Because again, visionary leader can be a real asset, and they expect you to say, no, we can't, and they're not going to listen to you right out of the gate. So you've got to put some legwork in before you can come back with an informed complaint, let's say. Mm-hmm. So like you said, chart this out, right? Do it. All right. Let's play the game. What are we going to have to do to make this happen? You know, there's a John Kennedy gave the famous speech, you know, we will send a man to the moon and return him safely to work. And as he was making that speech, people at NASA were spitting out their coffee saying, we're going to do what? He didn't get that goal from them. He handed that goal to them. And then they had to figure out how to make that happen, right? So sometimes you can connect the dots. But what does that mean? Do you need a bigger budget? Do you need more people? Do we need more aggressive pricing because we're going to have to hit this growth at the expense of profitability? I don't know what it is, but, you know, chart a course and then go to your boss or your boss's boss or, you know, follow the chain of command and say, if we're going to get there, this is what we need. And then at least you're broaching the subject in a constructive way to say, if you can give us this, then we can make that happen. But these things are linked. This isn't just going to drop from the sky where we're going to have this kind of growth, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
You got to do something more constructive than, you know, oh, hell no. Like, you can't start with that. You've got to build up to that. The other thing I would say is, you know, give it a month or two. You know, do what you can do, and then come back with some feedback, some concerns, like, you know, we hit the ground running, and this is the word on the street. This is the feedback we're getting. These are the early results. You know, we're way off track. Am I doing something wrong, or is it this goal? You know, understanding you've linked this to a bonus for this year, so I understand you've got some urgency. So you know, these things can happen pretty quickly. But I would wonder, you know, in the interest of self-preservation, is there some low-hanging fruit that you can tackle, you know, soon, first quarter? Certainly this year. Do you know somebody that's ready to buy more from you? And at least you can stack some early wins and, you know, at least don't put that whole bonus at risk while you're trying to figure out, I don't know where I go after this, but I know where I'm going to go first. Does that make sense?
Yes. Well, I was thinking that you brought up, because I hadn't thought, the discretionary bonus is by definition discretionary. So if you lay the plan out in 5 years, maybe you can shape the plan in a way that the real growth will happen in years 3, 4, and 5. My point being here is there's also a way to shape how they perceive you are doing, the CEO. So in that sense, I would use, and it, as it's discretionary, they would say, well, we're not getting the growth we wanted in year 1 because we weren't supposed to. It's planned to do it in the later years. So my point is maybe there's a way to shape the message as well that doesn't curtail the opportunity of a bonus.
Yeah, no doubt. But it just certainly sounds like this is pretty far-fetched, and now I understand why there's so much kind of content in this letter. Jack, is this anything you ever run into? I mean, you know, especially as you're on tour, you've got all kinds of logistical challenges as the traveling party gets from point A to point B, break it down, set it up, do it again. Does it ever feel like what you're being asked to do is just, you know, beyond the realm of possibility? And if so, you know, any tips for how you might handle something like that?
I'm not usually dealing with any of the money of things. I mean, as a director, we're faced with challenges more often where we don't have the equipment or the gear that we need, but they still want the show to look a certain way or have a certain production level to it. So there's, you know, some similarity there, but I often just look at that as like a challenge. It's kind of fun to be like, all right, well, we don't have the ideal package here, but maybe we can use technology or just, you know, look at some things from a different angle. But there isn't usually someone over our head, you know, looking at what we create and being like, well, this sucks, and like, this isn't what we said, you know. It's but that's, you know, there's a lot of times logistic things with the show where the different departments, you know, they design a show that has 5 or 6 different elements: sound, carpentry, video, lighting, and it all kind of has to fit on one stage or within one space. And you can kind of prep and plan as much as you want, but once you get all those different elements and trusses and production and, you know, motor points together, it doesn't really actually, you know, you can't predict all of the ways that they're going to interact with one another. So there is like sometimes this, what we're talking about in the question is like, how are we going to actually do this now that we've got the physical elements on site here? So it's like, you know, it all looks good on paper, but you're like, oh my God, this thing weighs a ton and we don't have the space to actually fork this deck off the stage. So there is like, you know, and if you have a boss who's like, well, just make it work, you know, that's not fun at all. But most of the time there's a solution.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Go ahead.
It's so fascinating. And it's so, as I'm listening to you talk, it's like, oh my gosh, like I just take for granted, you know, we go to a show, you see a production, but you've got to sort of deliver an expression of that in a place that is a completely different size and shape each time. Right. So of course it's like, you know, I would imagine it's a puzzle, right? How do we pull off the best version of this production given the constraints that we have? There's probably a creative element of, maybe I'm being kind, it's a pain in the ass or problems to solve, but also maybe some creative expression of how do we pull this off, you know, in this place we've never been to before that is smaller or larger, deeper or taller, or whatever it is you're dealing with.
Yeah, it's true. I think it's especially true for like doing festivals and things like that, where you're rolling in, you maybe don't have the time you would have or the rigging points you need or the space and all of these things. And you're like, well, we're supposed to deliver something that's near what we create, you know, when we tour a show. And then you're thrown into a festival and you're like, oh, well, we're just gonna, you know, the audience probably doesn't know the difference. So you just try to make something that you're proud of, and it may be not exactly the vision that you normally present, but you like, you know, make choices that you can deal with at the end of the day. And if the kids are happy, then you're, you know, you feel like you've done your job.
But going back to our storyline here, this audacious goal, this three times your size and all that, I think there's ego attached to that. But again, what I want to make reference to what Tim said earlier about the example of going to the moon, the 10 years. Now, there was also what we didn't talk about is how much it costs us to get there. And there was, I think, if I remember, something like some percentage, like a percentage points of our GMP, like 2% of the national GMP was allocated to get that thing done. So you have to throw resources at it. I'll give you another example because it fits with Jack's world, is that ball in LA, or I'm sorry, in Vegas, you know, that
the sphere?
The sphere.
Yeah.
The sphere. Well, that's a beautiful thing now that it works, but the first company that started it went bankrupt. And so these audacious, the point of Jack saying, oh, wow, we can do this. But the first company went under, and only a second company came along who bought the remains and took it over, did it. So we don't talk about, what we do is we cite examples, not we in this call, but people cite examples that make the case, but they're citing an exception versus what typically happens. You see what I'm saying? So this CEO might cite an example, well, so-and-so got us on the moon in 10 years, we can certainly grow in 5. And my point, but I think sometimes you have to come back to the real.
There's no doubt. There's so many, you know, classic case studies and stories that we use, write-ups in Harvard Business Review or whatever, that are kind of after the fact reverse engineered as if this were some deliberate plan that always works, when the reality is this is a success story and we're trying to glean what we can learn from it. Right. But you're right, Chris, about, and it goes back to this letter and the advice, which is what would it take to make this happen, and kind of laying that out to somebody who might not have thought through all the details. And they may say, hey, you know what, maybe this is a little bit ambitious, or what the heck, let's fund this. One quick nugget, because I love talking about, you know, from the earth to the moon. One of the things they did was had spent $1 million, this is in the 60s, I guess, right? Mm-hmm. At NASA, developing a pen that would write upside down, you know, trying to solve all these zero gravity problems, right? Uh-huh. And you know what the Russians did?
No, what?
Used a pencil. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, there's a little lesson in there as well.
There is a lesson in there. By the way, one other lesson that Tim should have mentioned, but I will mention on his behalf. This conundrum that is being faced by this person, this is why you hire a person like, you hire Tim. And then Tim does your homework. And because he's an outsider, he has no skin in the game. There's no consequence to him making a recommendation as to can this be done or can this not be done. And if it is to be done, this is how you're going to do it. My point being is you have a third party who is objective to this and ego absent. That's what we do.
That's so kind of you to bring that up, Chris. Lessons in Strategery, Parts 1 and 2 from January of this year, if anybody's interested. But yeah, that's why it's an iterative process. The, you know, who are we? Where are we going? How are we going to get there? The where are we going and how are we going to get there? You go back and forth between these two to make sure that before this goal is kind of published and goes live in your company or organization, you figured out exactly what it's going to take to get there and you're good with it, or you change the goal.
I'm good. Well, this was great. I hope I wish you well, biz dev person. So, hey, by the way, since we're fishing for sponsors, I thought I'd bring one up, and it's an old hat. It's when I say an old hat, it's one of my favorite simple instruments. An instrument is really, I call them an instrument because what they are these. This is a person. It's not a personality profile. It's called DISC. DISC is the discernment profile, they call it sometimes. It's available in the marketplace, and it's a very simple four-quadrant model that identifies whether or not you are a director, a driver, an intuitive, a conscientious, or a steady. And the model is simply about matter of, are you more task-focused? Are you more behaviorally or people-focused? Are you assertive, or are you responsive? And when you put yourself in one of those four quadrants, it tells you a little bit about how you typically communicate. I've always used it over the years repeatedly. Clients like it. They get it right away. Everyone sort of gets the hang of it. It works in many situations, even with this boss that we alluded to in our last segment, because this boss has a type. And so you get to that person's, how do they take in their information? And this little DISC profile gives you some insights on how to talk to somebody who has a preference that may not be your own. Anyway, I would hope that DISC hears us and maybe sponsors us for future reference. Tim, have you used DISC?
No, I've heard about it. I've heard you mention it. I'm kind of aware of it in the periphery, but that's fantastic. You create some awareness, some insight, you know, where people are coming from. You kind of get to the right answer faster. Mechanically, Chris, how does this work? Are you a certified in DISC? Does someone need to be? Can someone download a form? Or if they were interested, what would they do?
Yes, I am certified, but there are millions of people that are certified in DISC. In fact, you can probably go through a certification process. You buy the forms. You can buy the forms in a paper version, because I'm old school, or you can buy the forms in electronic versions. And it takes only about 15 minutes to fill it out. You can either self-score it, or you get a report back. But what I like about it, again, it gives you a quick insight into your preferred communication style. And that plays, because it has advantage for knowing, because what you want to do is you want to make sure that you adapt your style to meet the needs of another, which often we do not do. And that's where I think the real learning comes in. I would like to connect with you more readily, so I should try speaking closer to what you want. Are you a task-focused person who is really very assertive? Then I will have to give you something quickly and I will, you know, not have a lot of small talk. You see what I'm saying? The insights are useful to exchanges.
I love that. Adapting to the needs of another, as we learned 2 weeks ago, helping the aging boxer into the bed.
Exactly. Oh, that's a reference to my old dog, Lola. That's sweet. Okay, well,
wonderful.
Anyway.
DISC, we great.
DISC it is. So how about, maybe they'll call us. We'll see. How about you?
We
got another question?
We can help. I do. So here's one that's from Doing the Hustle in Houston. Hi, Chris and Tim. I'm a senior associate at a law firm. I started my career in the Midwest and just relocated to Texas. Yeehaw, I added that part, as part of a job change for my wife. It has been quite an adjustment. I can get used to the humidity, even the hats and the boots, but the client expectations might be a deal breaker. I like this person. One of our major clients is a big player in the oil and gas space. This client expects everything to be done on a ridiculous timeline. Things that should take weeks, they want done in a few days. Things that should take days, they want done this afternoon. Doesn't make any sense. These are totally artificial deadlines. We know when the filings are due, but that doesn't seem to matter to them or to my colleagues. Nobody pushes back. I don't want to work nights and weekends on things that are not urgent. I've been here 3 months, long enough to know this is a recurring problem, but maybe not long enough to start rocking the boat. Do I have enough tenure to raise this issue? And if so, how would I go about this? Again, signed, Doing the Hustle in Houston. Wow, what a thoughtful question.
It is. Do you want to go first, Tim, or do you want me to go first? What would you
like? No, go ahead. I'm going to get a drink of water after reading that long letter.
Well, I thought this was a very interesting question. I could go in a lot of directions on this question. First of all, I think one of the things that we're missing is the, I don't know enough about this firm you're a part of. You're a senior associate with this firm. And the question then becomes, too, who's bringing this business in? Because that's a key point. Is there a rainmaker, somebody who's bringing the business? Secondly, who is managing the client and the work that is being done? And third, who is actually doing the work? My sense of this is there are layers here. And so the relationship is held at a higher level with this particular client. The doing of the work is what you've been assigned to do, puts you down further down the food chain. And the problem with this is you have only been there 3 years and you are an associate still, so you probably don't have as much clout as to changing how the work is done. You see, I also think because they are getting the outcomes that they want, meaning this client is saying, I want this, and they're used to getting it, they are probably paying a premium to do so. So I call this, you are working in what's called a greedy job. And I don't mean greedy in the sense that you are greedy in the money that you will rake in, but greedy in the time it takes you to do the work you do. You have to spend a significant amount of time. This is the work of a woman named Claudia Golden, who won a Nobel Prize because she looked at gender in terms of the gender pay gap. And greedy jobs consume time that you have to sacrifice on your personal life to do what you need to do. In your world, your world, this is defines that. My advice here, quite frankly, is I'd stick with a job. I'd do it for at least a while. Nobody's going to listen to you about we should do it sooner. I don't know about nobody's going to listen, but you'd have to have some kind of skill set that is so unique that you were not replaceable, that they would then allow you to do that. You know, the equivalent would be at these tech firms. Some of the key programmers are the divas of the firm because they design what needs to be done to get the work done, and therefore they have a lot of clout. I'm not convinced that you have that level of clout in a 3-month window of time with them. So having said that, I would say, look, this is a training ground. You could learn under pressure here. You're learning to work under pressure. You're learning about efficiency, about tenacity, about your own abilities under fire. You're learning about yourself here. Now, if after a year you feel you can't get into the rhythm of this kind of work the way they want to do it, then I'd say you're getting burned out. Then you remove yourself and you find yourself a lifestyle firm. A lifestyle firm is one that you're not going to make as much money, but you're going to have some of your life back. Anyway, that's my advice.
Yeah, so much good stuff in there. Chris, I know you deal with a lot of professional services firms, a lot of law firms. So just for the benefit of the listeners, the tiers in the pyramid, is it associate, senior associate, partner, where this person's in the middle, or is it typically more complicated than that?
No, they usually have steps like, well, again, it depends on the firm, but you probably have 6 or 8 years of associate, 8 to 10 years of associate. Then you might make partner, or you might be in counsel. That means you won't be a partner, but you're a senior lawyer, or then you become you can be an equity lawyer or a non-equity owner. So there's layers throughout this. But my point is they're further down the food chain, and I don't think again, the relationship is being held probably at a higher level. And so they're not going, the person who has to change the deadlines is the person at the top of the organization.
Higher up for sure. So exactly. So much good stuff in what you said. And I think, you know, you start out asking several questions here. I have some too, just for context. First one would be, is this the one client that gets this treatment, or do we handle everybody this way? Right. Is this the nature of, of serving the oil and gas industry in Houston, which, you know, seems like a good place to do it. But is that, you know, are we, you know, kind of running with the big dogs here? How does that work? Then, you know, maybe as you said, this person is very self-aware, lower on the totem pole and new to the firm. So we've got a double whammy. And I think that self-awareness in the question, have I been here long enough to rock the boat? I think we're both going to say no, but you've been there long enough to ask some questions and sort of sniff around what's the full picture here? Am I getting, you know, one set of service standards with one client, or is this what it's like to be at this firm?
Mm-hmm.
I, I think, you know, start by asking some of your colleagues, other senior associates, you know, is this what we do for everybody or just for this one and why? You know, there's maybe somebody a level above you. Seems like these folks have high expectations for us and, you know, lucky we're up to the task. Tell me about this relationship. Is this how we won the business or is this how we keep the business or is this just how it is? Mm-hmm. Maybe some, you know, seemingly curious but not critical questions. So you try to figure out, all right, is this the firm for me or not?
Right.
I like your idea of hanging out for a year. Give it a year. Yeah, that's kind of a nice chunk of time on your resume if this isn't the place for you. Then, you know, you can deal with it. Maybe not yet, but there are consequences from this kind of thing. You burn out the team. Maybe there's some overtime. Maybe there are hidden costs of inability, opportunity costs is the phrase I'm looking for. Mm-hmm. Things you're not doing with other clients, other billing you can't take on because you have to keep this time available to drop everything at a moment's notice. You know, and maybe that's just how it is with this client. But I would say, you know, leverage your newness to ask questions, you know, mm-hmm. genuinely curious questions that are not necessarily critical. Get the lay of the land here and then figure out maybe can you navigate to a different client? Is this the client you want to be on to make your bones at this firm? You know, are you in the catbird seat and you don't even know it? You know, spend a little time getting the lay of the land. And I like that idea of take a medium view. I'm going to be here a year and mm-hmm. then I'm going to reassess and see if this is the place for me.
Yeah, I'm with you on all of that. Because again, he's in a situation where if you're learning something, continue to learn until you're tired of learning at the rate you're learning, I guess, would be part of this. Because I love your point about, is this a cultural issue or an incident relative to one particular partner's way of managing a client?
Right.
Yeah. No, right. I think that's great.
And that goes back to what you mentioned about ego, right? So, you know, in the letter, this person mentions that we know when the filings are due. So in other words, we know that the turnaround time is unnecessarily short.
Exactly.
But maybe there's some reason for that. Maybe there's some steps that the client is taking after you hand this over. Mm-hmm. Maybe they got other matters going on with their internal legal department, and so they need to get to the next thing, and you're not aware of it. There may be a valid reason for what seems like unnecessary rushing. So let's just spend a little time and make sure it is unnecessary rushing, and then you can decide, are you good with that or not?
Yeah, this is one of Tim's sweet spots again. It's about do your homework. I mean, that's what he does. That's what Tim does for, I think, in a living. He does the homework, and then you make the decision. But you don't make the decision absent of knowing. Yeah, we helped him. I think we helped this person.
I think so. At least some food for thought there. Stuff to think about as you navigate the waters in humid. Houston is humid. I don't know if you ever spent time there in the summer.
It is a wet place.
It's very wet.
It's wet.
All right. Should we put a bow on this?
Yes. This was good.
Wonderful. Thanks to everyone who made it to this point of the podcast. Next week, we have a buzz-worthy episode. Open up the door. It's Dave. Dave's not here. Just in time for 420, we're going to talk about marijuana. Do weed and work mix? So that is, you know, set your calendars for that. Chris, thank you for sharing your wit and your insight and your discernment technology via disc. Thank you, Jack, for producing and jumping in cluing us into the occasional lack of rigging points at a festival setting. That was very cool to hear about that. And of course, thanks to all the listeners. We want to hear about the drama, the dilemmas, the conundrums you face at work. Send your emails to info@cubicleconfidential.com. New episodes every Wednesday. We hope you have a great week. Cubicle Confidential, signing off.